This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
Well, we've been trying to learn some things about interpreting our Bibles. There are principles. You could call them rules for doing a good job of interpreting the Bible, which we all have to do a good job of because we all want to read it. And to read it right, to understand it, especially even for yourself, even if you're not teaching it, just to understand why you're going to be interpreting things. It's inevitable. You will interpret. If you read a thing, you are interpreting that thing. So, we want to do it well. So, how do I do it well? There are principles or rules. So, this word right here encapsulates what I would think would be rule number one. Rule number one, biblical interpretation is context. Context. Yes. In fact, I've heard people say before that there are three rules. Guy used to say this all the time. Three rules interpreting something in the Bible. Rule number one is context. Rule number two, yeah? Context! And obviously rule number three was context. It's a big deal, context. So we'll take a little time here and think about the idea of a context. The fact that everything we read, no matter what it is, anything you ever read, comes in the middle of some other stuff. So a context, and we're talking here about specifically literary context. There are other everything. Context means a lot of things. I mean, you exist in a context, you know, right? But here we're thinking of context in a literary sense. That anything you ever read, and we do a lot of reading sections and pieces and sentences. We call them verses, you know, or chapters or passages or, you know, whatever the length is, we read in pieces. And there is no text you can ever read that doesn't have a context. I mean, there are obviously the words words before it and words after it. So it's not like just opened up and there was a white page with just that sentence, right? There were other things around it, and so every text then has a context. So, though I've just described it, I will show you a definition. I believe I might have a definition of the word that someone else gives me. Yes, every text has one, right? Let's go to the next. So, context could mean things general. So, generally speaking, a context could be circumstances or a setting for any event. So it can be broadly understood, right? Like that sentence says, a decision within the context of plans. This is like a financial statement. But we're interested in that second one there. The parts of something written or spoken that immediately precede and follow a word or passage and clarify its meaning. So, that's what we mean. We're talking about a context, particularly in Bible reading, but it applies to other texts as well. In fact, you've all written things yourself, haven't you? You've all written at least letters.
Well, when I was in college, we had to write an essay.
You've written essays. Now that's, yeah, sure. All of you can go back to days when you had to write. You wrote something for a grade. Back when you went to college, that must have been a few years ago.
A lot.
3 or 4 or 5, you know, whatever it was.
That was when I was a girl.
And so, when you did that, right up to today, an email that you wrote, you would not want someone, I take it, to isolate something you wrote and act like it meant something that you didn't mean for it. You didn't intend. Right? You would expect it. Anything you said, let's say you made some kind of a joke. Not that I would know anything about this myself, but, you know, some of us are sometimes given to, I don't know, expressions or little bits of sarcasm. Well, in other words, we don't necessarily mean what we're kind of horsing around. We wouldn't want someone to take it literally. We wouldn't want someone later to just take that one phrase and tell a crew, he said this. Of course, you know, that's why don't ever run for office, because guess what? These days, if you ever run for office, that's what they're going to do. They're going to find everything you ever wrote, and they will find sentences, phrases, terms, and they will take them out of context to paint you as whatever they want. So there is a warning that I will give you, though, and it may sound strange. It may strike you as odd, but let me show this warning here. I didn't make this, okay, but I thought it was great. I thought it was great. Someone else made it. This warning, it shows an open Bible, and it says, warning, do not read a single verse from this book. Now, of course, somebody could make that who hates the Bible and who thinks it's a terrible and destructive message, and they wish that you would not even, they wish that they want to tell you, do not even ever read so much as a single verse. But the person that I think actually made this might have a different idea in mind. They might not be saying, this is a terrible book, you shouldn't even read a verse from it. They might be saying something more along the line of what we're saying. What would that be? I see Anita's looking at me. They're saying, do not read a single verse. If you just read a single verse from this book, and that's all you ever read, well, you're not going to understand this book. This book will require more than a single verse. Not, by the way, there are a few single verses that say a lot in a few words, and you could gain a lot of understanding from some short clips. I mean, it's not as if you couldn't get some understanding. This is why for years and years, Christians would, I don't see it as much anymore, actually, would promote John 3:16 all the time. I don't know why that's not as much a thing as it used to be, but you remember a time when it was on banners? I mean, you would see bumper stickers, that's all it would say. And remember watching football way back when, every time somebody scored a touchdown, the John 3:16 banner would go up behind the, you would be raised up behind the goalpost? This has fallen out of favor, and athletes once in a while put the eye black under there, and they'll have it. Because one of the ideas behind highlighting that verse for all those years was the notion that, why, here is a verse that sort of within it kind of condenses and it packs into one single verse a sort of distilled gospel message right here. It's all packed in. So it's not as if one verse can't say a lot. But generally speaking, as a reader, if you want to really grow and understand, you would not open the book and only read a single verse. Well, someone has said this better. And I have a little booklet. I have this little booklet. I should have brought it, but I'll show you a picture of it here. This little booklet here called Never Read a Bible Verse. Again, I mean, I'll probably go in for a title that might grab the attention or provoke somebody in some way. But the gentleman who wrote this, again, I have it. I could have found it. It's a thin little thing. It's a little paperback. But all he's doing in this is teaching this one simple lesson about being a person who learns to read beyond just the one verse at a time. Because there is a tendency, as I say on that last point, there is a widespread tendency among lots of church-going Christians today.
I can do all things. The reverse taken out of context.
Oh, come on now. Yes. A verse a day keeps the devil away. You know, it's this idea that the Bible is a collection of single. It's, you know what the Bible is for a lot of them? It's those calendars people used to have, maybe you still do, that every day, right? You tear off the one before, and every day there's a sentence, there's a quote or something. It's just one thing. And sometimes and
I have one that has a verse.
And some of them have a verse, like exactly. There's nothing wrong with being reminded of a particular verse, but if that is the primary or only way you approach the Bible, if that simply is what that is to you, it is a verse a day calendar to you. That's it. Then what this book's saying is trying to say, as part of Christian growth, there should be far more to the story than just the single verse reading. And because single verse reading it's prone to possible errors. And some of the worst abusers of the text, all right, those that have committed the greatest crimes, against theological crimes against what the Bible says, have tended to do it by ripping things from context And that's easy. That's fairly easy to do. We'll have more examples down the road of that. But as I say, look, we call it a verse. It's just basically a verse is a sentence. Verse is a word we now use to, like, we use verse to, like a song? A song has verse, a verse in it,
poetry.
Right? Poetry has verse. But in the biblical sense, when we say a verse, we are referring to usually a sentence. I think in some cases it might be a couple of sentences, or sometimes it's a sentence and a half. Occasionally a verse breaks after a comma. It's kind of weird. I don't know how these decisions were made. I know this, they weren't part of the original, okay? As I probably said before, gospel writers, apostles, psalmists never sat down originally and said, I think I'll write the 23rd Psalm now. Verse 1, that's not how they went about it. Verses are added later, much later. Paul did have Greek doesn't have the same English grammar, so you can get by with Ephesians 1 that just tacking on clauses in order that, so that, such that. It's like, man, your teacher would have circled that whole thing and said, run on. But hey, it's first century Greek, and you can pull that sort of thing off. But if we look at it as a if we do what can be our tendency, overemphasize the verses, overemphasize the idea that this is just a collection of verses, and forget that no, this is a letter, this is a whole, this is a continued thought from start to finish, just like a story is that way. Narrative always begs for the before and the after, because nobody grabs a novel, opens to page 185 and just starts reading. And then reads, let's say it's a 500 pager. That'd be a pretty big one, I guess, right? Let's say it's a big one. And you read from 185 to 340 and then you say, I'm done. Well, that'd be a strange way to read a novel. You didn't get the first part that set the whole thing up. You didn't get the end of where how it all resolves. You just got a chunk of the middle. It'd be very weird. So we understand that narrative isn't that way. You want to know what happened before this, we got to this, and what happened after this. Sometimes, though, we might forget that some other things aren't that way. Maybe if we're looking, I do think there might be an exception. There are, as we said, some of the Proverbs that are kind of individual verse. Some of the little Proverbs will stand alone, and they don't necessarily relate to the proverb before, the proverb after. Sometimes that's true. And in that sense, you can... Proverbs are maybe more than any other thing. You remember we talked about the genres? Maybe more than any other type, a proverb can lend itself to fragmentation like that, because it is a compilation of sayings. There's a little else really that easily lends itself to that. Even though obviously you can always take. I mean, sometimes Paul might just have something great to say. He may just put it out there. And you might say, wow, kind of like I can do all things. You say, well, then that really latch onto that. I love how he put that. And that's okay, because he said what he said. But if a person has been a Christian many years and that's all they ever knew about what he said there, they never had read up to it before and what came after it, they never saw the greater context, so we're robbing ourselves. And to some extent, getting a full appreciation and understanding of a particular verse, it requires us to look before and after a lot of times, right?
As Paul Harvey would say, get the rest of the story.
You need the rest of the story, You need to know what else. Right. That's right. You're just picking off the plate. You just grab a grape, here. A green bean. You eat the way some of your kids do, right? Used to eat, right? Not the right way. You're not getting the full picture. So it's a habit that we can overly indulge in, because what makes us do that, by the way? I mean, what would make a seasoned Christian live a life for years and years and years that is essentially a verse here and a verse there and never anything more?
Letting laziness.
Well, then I appreciate your bluntness going straight to that. I mean, some of it's just laziness. It's like, oh God, reading this is hard. Yeah, you don't want to. Maybe you feel like I don't want to feel like I'm in school here. It's hard work, and we're busy. So a lot of times we think. I mean, the most well-intentioned Christians might say, "I really want to read the Bible. I really want to understand it. I really want to know it. I really want it to speak to me. I really want to live according to it." So, but gosh, I got 6 minutes.
You know?
Great point. That is a good point.
They just learned that, if you need something to read, hey, this is good to read.
Yeah, that's interesting. I sometimes wonder if it's something like this. I thought this before. That, look, obviously the Bible, people raised in church will always see it as different. And in the best possible way. Well, this is the book of books. This book supersedes other books. Yes. But they will sometimes fail to see it as a book. It's almost like, well, to actually take something and read all the way through it and take it all in all, that's what you do with a regular book. But the Bible is almost like the magical book of special sayings. And, you know, sometimes there's an overly magical, even almost borders on a pagan understanding of the text. Like, its words are like magic formulas that have some kind of special power. Some people almost look at it that way, like read a verse and the words do things and... you just need to find a selection or a piece of it. It's instead of understanding it as... So I guess some people might think, well, you're taking away from it. If you look at... And I think sometimes this... I've felt like some people have been saying this to me in the past, just occasionally. Over the years, you know, you will talk about the Bible in this way that sometimes maybe I do, and where you're getting down to business. Like, you know, I dig in and talk about backgrounds and... I mean, remember that Hebrews thing I talked all about? Who wrote it? You know, and we did that whole spiel. And some people, I think, will get the idea that, hey, don't talk about it like all that with all that academic detail. You're right. You're taking away the magic. You know? You're taking away the magic. They almost would rather have what some of the cults have, which is a magical book that dropped out of the sky. You know? Like, it doesn't have a history. It doesn't have a background. It doesn't have... ancient manuscripts, it doesn't have archaeology. It's almost like, you know, some of the other groups have holy books that you have to trust one person who says, this was delivered to me. Some people almost want that. They almost want that because it's simple and magical. And whereas the Bible's like got all this history to it. It's you know what I mean? Like it's got the soil in it. You know what I mean? It's got the stuff of earth all on it because it actually is a real... Those are real people who lived and all that.
And some of them view the King James as saying, that came from King James, you know.
Yes.
They don't realize all the background in just the King James version. A lot of the newer ones, yeah, they knew it was a committee, but that one's got King James.
And because we know that's what we're supposed to do. There was a time in this church where, in Sunday school, a person came around every Sunday, and they wanted to know who read their Bible.
This was common.
Every day, mm-hmm. And how much did you read? And they recorded it. But he didn't want me to read the Bible just to read the Bible, just so I could check that off my list.
Okay,
this is what a Christian
I see what you
does.
Mean. Like it becomes a duty.
Yes.
It's like your dentist says I got to floss. The church says I got to read the verses.
And
you know.
So I started praying, Lord, and that's just something personally that.
Well,
it
may be that when people are younger or sometimes a newer Christian or, you know, they're developing the habit, the discipline.
That's okay.
But you're right. I think the goal for all believers, the goal in bringing people to completion, bring people, you know, to try to present everyone as complete in Christ. The goal is a maturity that gets a person to where. You need it. It sustains you. There is real food there. There's real nourishment, and you take it in, and it, you know, and your mind almost chews and getting the nutrients out of it, and it kind of You know, and then you're able to apply it to what's happening to you in your life. I mean, this is the standard way it should be. Probably churches, you know, they'll try to think of any way to have, that was probably thought of as a helpful way to keep add accountability. And I know that in other denominations, the same thing was always true. And even if it wasn't asking you what did you read and how much, there would at least be these things that everyone got. You would say, this week it's like read Bible. You know what I mean? Like you check it. And I guess some people might have thought, well, I don't want to be a hypocrite, and I don't want to check the box if I didn't do it. So maybe there's some accountability, because you know otherwise you're like, well, what does the church get a benefit from that? Are they going to count the check marks and say, yay, 80% this week? I don't know. But it's always been thought of as a discipline you want people to do. There was a time people, frankly, had more reading stamina. There's no doubt about it. This kind of gets back to what we were just saying. If times have changed in some ways that contribute to our lack of it, some of those contributions would involve the pace of life being quicker, us having our schedules being so crowded with a billion things we're going to do every day, and not a lot of quietude, because really, to really be a good student, a good reader, you need time and you need a little silence, and we don't have a lot of that. Or you sit down and in the back of your mind, you know there's a running clock going. At 11, I gotta do this guy's gonna call me at whatever. I gotta do, and that's like the pressure of that. So you're always on the clock. Like, how much of this can I get in before time's up? And I don't know, that doesn't allow you the freedom that maybe once people had, where you sat down and imagine not having that. Imagine not having the clock running, where you're just like, all right. I mean, obviously I'm got dinner later or something. I got something later, but it's like I'm not on the clock. And I'm just going to see where it goes and, you know, take a general amount of time. There's a lot of differences in that.
Sometimes sitting large volumes can create that clock effect.
Yeah.
Today.
Yeah.
And God goes, hey, look at that.
Parallels.
I'm going to take care of this.
It's amazing to see those kind of timeless things.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's like, here we are, you know, it's 1,500 years after the fact, and yet this couldn't be more relevant. I mean, because people don't change. And so when it comes to this, part of what we're doing here is a thing that's got a sort of a funny name, and I shall show it to you, the hermeneutical spiral. By the way, if you want to be a good quarterback, you got to learn to throw a tight hermeneutical spiral. Back up one there, soldier. Wait, is that the next one up? Did I skip one?
Can't make slides from here from nowhere.
Uh-oh. Hey, go one. Or, yeah. Okay, my bad. Maybe that's not in there. Okay, back it up then. Back up the truck. Go to this. Got my guy right here. But before I read that quote that you can read yourself, I think that's pretty visible. There is a thing here that I just mentioned here. So hermeneutical is just the $2 word for interpretation. And so what we're trying to do in terms of context is you can think of in terms of the forest and the trees, right? This is a common analogy. Forest and the trees. Some people call it the hermeneutical circle. What they mean is, imagine then the attempt to understand a forest. Sounds a little weird, understand a forest. But let's just pretend for a minute that you're some kind of like super duper arborist and you're some kind of like, you know, genius when it comes to trees. You know what I mean? So you want to understand a certain forest, a small forest. And the idea is, what is the forest but a compilation of many trees? And if you understand the whole thing, that is whatever, the ecosystem of it and so on, you will understand each tree better. But as you study each tree better, you will understand that forest better. You see where I'm going here? So by studying each piece, you're getting a picture of the whole better. And you can use a lot of analogies. You could use the human body in a similar way. If I want to understand the overall health of a person, well, I might analyze several systems and parts to them. They've got several organs, they've got organ systems. All these, and as I understand those parts, though, I'm getting a picture filled out of their general overall health. And then, as I'm forming a better picture of their overall health, then that's a context where I'm now able to see the parts better. Like, in other words, I might come to the assessment that they have a certain condition, generally. And now, knowing that condition, I see what's going on in their liver or their kidney or whatever in light of that condition. But I wouldn't have known the condition as well without studying the parts. I think you get the picture. So we're talking about reading the Bible in such a way that you have verses, you have smaller parts that it's perfectly fine to dig into them. You know, once in a while I'm up here teaching and I'm like really dive into one verse, don't I? And parse out. I mean, look at the Greek word, because you're understanding that verse as well as you can. You're trying to really understand that, and that. So that's like the microscope. That's looking at a small piece. But what that does, if I can come to understand that pretty well, what that's doing, it's helping me see the bigger letter more. So let's say we're going to study Philippians. You know, well, what am I going to, how can I know Philippians well and understand its message and get all the treasures it has? Well, I want to look. I don't want to just be sloppy and just read past everything super light speed and blah, 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 blah. I might want to savor some of that. I might want to stop and contemplate and chew on some of these, you know what I mean? Some of the smaller pieces. But as I'm doing it, I'm getting a bigger picture of everything it teaches. But then, if I get the bigger, as I'm getting the bigger picture of everything it teaches, then that's helping give me the right context to understand chapter 4, verse 3. You know what I mean? Because I'm getting, and see how that's just, those two things are constantly feeding each other? So I actually think that there shouldn't be a debate. Christians should not be engaged in a debate of, I think you should carefully study verses one by one real closely. No, I think you should read entire chapters and even entire books in one sitting. They're both right. This is not an either or. That's a false dilemma. The fact is, occasionally, I would encourage it. Occasionally, if you've never done it even, just try to crank through a book. I mean, some books are easier than others. Like, if you want to sit down and read through Isaiah, go for it. That's biting off a big, big piece. But I guarantee you can knock off, you know, obviously, like, how about 1 John? Some things lend themselves to an easy read or a narrative, like one of the entire Gospels, all the way through, just all the way, just whole thing. It's not as hard as you might think. You can read through the whole thing. So you knock it the whole thing out, and if you do that, if you read through the whole thing, what you will find out is, wow, in some cases, if you never did it before, you'll be saying, wow, I never considered how all this stuff fits together because I never read it all the way through in one sitting. Do that once in a while. But then obviously sometimes zero in and do the deeper stuff. So you see the old spiral, what they call it. Good practice.
One thing that was helpful to me, I bought a chronological Bible.
Oh, yeah.
And that helped me. That was very revealing.
The chronological. Yeah, that'll teach you something too, because I don't think we talked about that, but how...
I always thought things happened in the Old Testament.
In the sequence of the books. Not so much. Not so much. Especially the old, for the most part, yeah. I mean, it's not entirely out of sync, but some of it is pretty far out of sync. So it's good. That's good. I like those. They are eye-opening, those chronologicals. We'll come back to this point at a later time, but I just thought I'd throw this at you here, what my man says. This is a good little proverb, okay? Everybody should remember this. And it's kind of poetic. You could set this to music. You could write a song. It's really good. A text without a context is a pretext for a proof text. Huh? How you like that? Yeah. That will preach, man. My friends, a text without a context is a pretext for a proof text. What's that mean? Well, here's what a proof text is. Here's what proof text is. Proof text is, well, I don't know if there it is, if you can read it. A scriptural passage adduced, there's a word for you, as proof for a theological doctrine, belief, or principle. In other words, hey, I got a belief. I think this is how it is. I want to prove it to you. Hang on a second. I'm going to find me a verse that'll back it up. So like, the belief kind of comes first. And if you're skilled enough, you can find a verse to back up something if you like it enough. Proof texting. Not all proof texting is like that. That's illegitimate kind of. There's proof texting that's okay because, as I say here, there can be a proof text that's legitimate. Like it actually does offer a reason. It does say the thing, right? I mean, that's obvious. And a proof text, notice the word text doesn't tell you if it's just a verse. So a proof text can be more than just a verse, but often it's just a verse. And, you know, this is when you have a problem. When someone, now all of you know what this is because you've experienced it. You've heard this stuff. I mean, you don't have to go. We've talked about some people. We've talked about groups and teachings in here, haven't we? Where they do that. Where they got some cockamamie belief about something. And you say, why do they believe that? What's in the Bible? Where? And then here comes a verse. And then, but see, closer. And by the way, it's okay. If someone quotes a verse, hey, you go and find out. Be a Berean, right? Go home and say, you know what? That guy said, that Paul said, that guy said, that Psalmist said, that guy said, that Jesus taught. I'm going to go find out. And then, but when you go find out, what you're going to do is you're going to read the context. That's what you're going to do. Because that's how we roll. That's how you have to do it. You go find out. So he claimed to quote a verse. Did he quote it right? Okay. Okay. Let's say he quoted it out of, you know, whatever, good translation. And it says what he says it says. That is, the words he said are actually, he didn't mess those up. But does it mean what he said it meant? For that, I got to know more. And look, you will find many places. I mean, when I lived those years in Utah, you know, I heard this all the time. If I ever said, hey, why do you guys go down there and get baptized in your temple for dead people? They would say to me, it's in the Bible. Now, I take it no one in here has been baptized for any of their dead. Why not? It's in the Bible. Don't you guys know that it's in the Bible? Did you know it's in the Bible? 1 Corinthians chapter 15, when Paul's talking about the resurrection. What then shall they do who are baptized for the dead? Well, there you go. If that's not the foundation for an entire doctrine, I don't know what is. You see, this is called proof texting. It don't mean what they said it means. You know, I could do this. I could have a lot of fun. You know that I could teach atheism from the Bible. I could. It says explicitly, there is no God. The psalmist said so. See how little context you had to have? All you had to do, you only had to widen the lens out like that far. All you needed was just like a handful of words of, well, that's context, see?
The cult would take people out of the Christian church because they misquoted the scripture.
Well, that's the way and this is why people have to be armed. They have to be good, solid readers. So that's really our point for the night is, rule number one of all interpreting of the Bible. Never forget it. Context. It just means with text. It's what's with the text? What's around it? What came before? What came after? How would I understand it? You don't want people abusing your words that way and twisting them to make you say things that you didn't mean. So imagine the crime of doing this with the Word of God. You're to slander God.